All right, so hello everyone. Welcome to our very first episode of our podcast, SANI. It's a science podcast meant to celebrate our African scientists as we discuss their work.
We are glad you have joined us as we celebrate and learn together. My name is Selassie, and I will be your host together with...
Yours truly, Alex. So today we are very grateful to be joined by Dr. Samoliwa. Dr. Samoliwa is an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky. His research focuses on innovative drug discovery through computer-aided drug design, genetic editing, and rigorous chemical synthesis of organic and inorganic molecule probes to interrogate human biology processes and diseases towards new therapeutics. His research lab is pivoted on three overarching themes involving drug discovery, chemical biology, and chemical immunology. So this evening, we are very grateful that Dr. Iwa has taken the time off to join us even as we begin our chat for our very first episode. So thank you very much, Dr. Iwa, and we are very glad that you've taken the time off to join us tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Alex and Selassie, for giving me the opportunity to be your maiden speaker, I guess, for this very innovative podcast series. So I'm glad to be here.
Glad to join us. So we want to begin our conversation first off. We just want to have a time of like personal background, going back to how it all started, how you got into science. Really bringing that African connection. How did it all start? Getting to where you are now as an assistant professor in the University of Kentucky?
That's a pretty loaded question, I think. So actually, when I was young, I had dreams of becoming either a detective or a pilot. I don't know, maybe I was watching a lot of CSI short videos. But then I had so much interest in trying to find things out, adventurous I was growing up. And that could tell among all the my siblings. Actually, I was very adventurous, and I think my mom could attest to that. And then I realized that there isn't a real clear educational pathway to become a detective in Ghana, where I grew up. And then I also realized later that becoming a pilot wasn't a joke in Africa. You may have to have some connection to travel abroad, things like that. So even though those were wonderful dreams that I had, but I saw that it was maybe a mirage. I may be chasing a mirage. So as I enrolled in school, my mother did a pretty good job growing up as Catholics, and we went to Catholic school. We're very, brought up in that Catholic tradition and so forth. So that shaped my upbringing for a while and throughout my life, even right now. Mm-hmm. But the good thing about school life was, even though we lived in an area that wasn't very noted for scholarly work and examples of accomplished people, there was one thing that stood out, that we went to a private Catholic school and all the people around us went to public schools. And we knew that public schools weren't that great, Mm-hmm. And so that distinction was very clear right at the onset. And so it made us, that's myself and my siblings, strive to achieve more, because when we went to school, the kind of people we interacted with were a little bit different when we came home, in terms of status and how English is even spoken and things like that. So that was a good thing. So that sacrifice, I credit that to my mom's tireless effort and sacrifices over the years to send us to good schools. And so making it into high school, I think arguably going to the best secondary school in Ghana. I think that's for debate at a later time.
Still at Yabo, then, yes.
So, or the only secondary school in Ghana. It was a very defining moment for me, because the one subject that I did so well in was chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the grades will come out, and we used to post the grades after every semester or after every year. And it's chemistry. That was my strength. And so I realized that maybe there's something that was great about chemistry that I need to pursue more. I just fell in love with the subject. The teacher was great, Mr. Afo. And it could tell in my grades. And so when I was applying into the university, I knew I didn't really want to do medicine or pharmacy or things like those were the things that the subjects or the professional career paths that people would easily jump on if you come out from the sciences in the high school. But I wasn't really into that. And so that what led me into chemistry. And when I was in college, at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology, that was also a very nice experience. Both shaped by faith and by hard work, I realized that, no, this is where I want to be. I want to be learn chemistry to the highest level. I want to do research to the highest level at college. And so when I finished, I spent a time being a teaching assistant. And I think that's where I met Dr. Alex for the first time, and also in Pax Romana. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I figured that if I wanted to do chemistry to the highest level, I needed to come to the United States. Nowhere else, the United States. And so I did a bunch of applications, hoping that I could get in with a scholarship in the United States. And thankfully, I did. And so I started off at South Dakota State University in the cold. And then my boss, that's my PhD mentor, Dr. Yongjae Yu, he's currently at Sunny Buffalo. He's a distinguished professor there now. So he got a job. He moved to Oklahoma University, University of Oklahoma in Norman. And so that gave us the opportunity to move all the way to the University of Oklahoma. And that's where I finished my PhD. And then when I finished my PhD, I had an opportunity to go to MIT to do the postdoc doctoral fellowship. And I think that was the place that really shaped me to be a true scientist, if I can say. There's a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy. Scientifically, the stimulation for high level science was great. And I was privileged to be mentored by a very outstanding scientist, Professor Stephen Leppard. And that's where it all began with my career before I got recruited at the University of Kentucky.
That's awesome.
So I had a quick question, a follow-up question. So, you know, back home in Ghana, a lot of the times when you want to do like the basic sciences, especially moving from high school to college, a lot of people will try to discourage you because they tell you that you end up being like a teacher. And so if you want to do mathematics or biology or chemistry, they just say that, well, if you do that, then you have no option but to then become just like a basic school, like a teacher teaching one of these basic sciences. Did you ever come across anyone discouraging you from doing chemistry? And looking back, do you think that could have prevented you from following, like seeing as now that's your dream, that's what has led you to where you are right now?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, you definitely would hear things like that, and I did, but I'm so grateful that my siblings, I had I'm the third of five, and my senior siblings who had gone ahead of me, because I'm the penultimate one, they were quite, encouraging in that respect. They thought that, yes, once you've done the science, if this is the path you want to go, I mean, all the blessings for that. And my mom too believed in education. She didn't really, she was not particular about, oh, you got to do medicine at all costs. Mm-hmm. Or you got to do pharmacy at all costs. You know, she was all about education. Get your first degree and then you can decide what you want to do
what
next.
What you want to do,
And so that was quite helpful for me. And that's where it all began. And I think that maybe as we go on, from hindsight, I realized that this is the best path for me, given that adventurous, curiosity-minded person that I was. This could have been the best option that I took.
Well, that's very different. That's very different. But yeah, but very encouraging as well. So that's I want to now delve into your current research. I want to talk a little bit about that. So we know that you do a lot of therapeutic work, a lot of drug design. But your work plays a lot of emphasis on the use of gold complexes for cancer treatment. So why the choice of gold in the first place?
Okay, so that's another, but let me backtrack a little bit and give a little bit of background. So I'm a trained organic chemist. So my PhD was in organic chemistry, but applied to medicinal purposes, therapeutics. But then when I was moving into doing my postdoctoral training, I got into a lab where it was focused on bio-inorganic chemistry. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of biology and inorganic chemistry put together. And so I the kind of work that I did in Professor Lippert's lab was focused on understanding the mechanism of action of a well-known drug that has been widely prescribed in the clinic, known as cisplatin. Cisplatin is a platinum-based therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And so I made contributions to that, understanding the mechanism and why it's quite sensitive in testicular cancers. Because testicular cancers would record up to about 100%, close to 100% remission for patients who are on cisplatin. So we're able to kind of unlock the biological mechanism surrounding that. And so starting my independent career, I realized that, I'm a synthetic chemist by training. And now I've tacked on a little bit more biology and inorganic chemistry. Mm-hmm. And so what would be the best challenging project in terms of chemistry and also with therapeutic value or biological promise? Okay. And so when you look at the periodic table, platinum and gold are on the same row. Right?
Okay.
It's just that gold is a little bit larger. And the chemistry of gold is very, very interesting. And so when I was realizing the United States, you didn't have a lot of people applying gold to biological purposes. Mm. And I was asking myself why, because it seemed like a no-brainer to me until we started working with gold, that it was so challenging chemically. You couldn't make chemically stable stuff. And I love challenges.
Yeah.
And so the goal was, how can we make gold, transform gold into a much more stable complex or compound that can last the assault of biological nucleophiles or biological reductants and can still have value either physiologically or pathophysiologically. To answer the question more directly, it was because of the challenging chemistry that is associated with gold, and it's because of its properties. It's highly relativistic, and so it has highly unexplored chemistries associated with it. So that was the driving force. And the challenge to turn this into novel chemistries, novel therapeutic, or let's say biological probes, mm-hmm. was of great interest for me. So that's why we entered into gold.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yes, I think that's actually really, really interesting. And I also really liked chemistry back in high school. It was one of my favorite subjects. And it's just very interesting that you go back to one of the basics of chemistry, which is talking about the periodic table. And I'm pretty sure if we have any of our high school students listening in, they will actually be just fascinated by the fact that even way up in your career, you're going back to some of these things that we learned way down in high school. So what influences what compounds are complex with gold? I know you were talking about gold being very complex to work with. And so we know with your research, what have you found about what influences the kind of compounds that are complex with gold?
Good. Yeah, so I think the key to making physiologically relevant gold compounds, either as chemical probes or as therapeutics, is stability. How do you stabilize the metal ion? And so my research lab and the work we've done so far is just developing ligand systems that can better stabilize these gold compounds. And what I mean by this is, again, we go back to fundamentals of chemistry. We look at the hard, soft acid base principles. And we look at how do these ligands donate electrons to the gold center so that it can be stabilized enough to just travel through the circulation if you're dealing in animals or even in vitro with cellular context or even lysates and things like that. So that's the key thing, ligand tuning, ligand design. And so for some of the work we've done so far, how do we generate gold carbon bonds known as organometallics or gold phosphine bonds because phosphines are strong sigma donors and things like that. So that at least when we put them together, we know that there's a good flow of electrons getting onto the gold, stabilizing the golds so that it can stay in solution for a longer period of time.
Wow.
So we noticed in most of the papers they were either using carbamates or phosphine to stabilize the gold particles to carry out whatever function. But apart from complexing the gold and making it stable, those other complexing agents have added functionality to it. So does it add a benefit in terms of functionality for the drug itself or carrying out whatever therapeutic effect it has?
Right. So with that, when we look at the ligands themselves hardly convey a therapeutic value. And actually that's what we want, except for one or a few of the phosphine ligands. But for the thiocarbamates, for instance, as you mentioned, if we look at the phenylpyridine that we use to generate the cyclometallated gold themselves, these do not have biological properties that we are using these gold complexes for. And so the complexation or the formation of the covalent bonding between these ligands and the gold center is what brings out the therapeutic benefit. And that's really what we want, because we want the selectivity for these agents. So far, we can say that for sure, we do not see the therapeutic value of the ligands themselves, but when they come together with the gold, because of the unique properties of the gold. And we can talk about that as well.
So are there any other potential transition metals or metalloids that can serve a similar purpose to gold? And are you exploring any of these?
Yeah, so they are. I mean, the chemistry of gold is a little bit similar to platinum. The difference with platinum is that platinum can form added coordination sites. You know, it has other coordination sites, because if you oxidize platinum to platinum 4, platinum 2 to platinum 4, you get six coordination sites. Gold hardly has that. These days, we found that we can kind of modify the geometry of gold to get an added coordination side. It's still a contentious issue within the field right now. Okay. Maybe at a later time when we have proven it with our publication, then we can discuss that. But the thing about other medals is that, yes, there are other medals that are a little bit akin to gold. So for instance, if you look at the period of gold, like silver, which comes and also mercury, but remember mercury is pretty toxic. So nobody wants to use mercury for anything therapeutic. And then silver too, the problem with silver is that silver hardly forms a lot more coordination sites. So you lack a lot of variability with the ligand choices and the ligand systems that can stabilize the gold center. So that's why it makes gold like a sweet spot for this. And maybe let me ask Selassie that, you see, gold has been used since 5000 BC in the context of medicine. You know, when you arrive from Egypt, in China, in the Mediterranean, through to the 1700s when it entered the British pharmacopoeia, and also later when it entered the US pharmacopoeia for the treatment of tuberculosis and syphilis and so forth. So that's, it's been around for a long, long time.
Wow. Long time.
And there's actually an FDA approved drug, Oranofin, which was approved in the 80s, 83 or 84 for rheumatoid arthritis. And it's still an FDA approved drug, which is has gold in it.
Okay, that's actually very, very interesting, talking about the fact that gold has been used in medicine for such a long time. Sometimes you go back and then you realize that some of the things that we are studying right now, our forefathers or those in the past, actually without as much knowledge as we have right now, were investigating some of these things. And it just tells you how much we are connected in so many ways. So you, in your submission earlier, you talked a lot about coordination sites. So for the sake of our listeners out there who don't really know so much chemistry, can you just explain what these coordination sites are, and why that's, because you talked about how that's the difference between platinum and gold. And so I feel like it's a very important aspect of what you're working with.
Very good. Yeah, so when we talk about coordination sites of any metal, so usually when we mine these metals, and so the country that we come from, Ghana, was formerly known as the Gold Coast. So, and up to today, we mine gold almost everywhere in the country, from the north to the south, there's gold. So when we mine it, it's in an oxidation state that is like zero oxidation state.
Okay.
And so we could, so the bands that we wear, the jewelry that we put on are all gold in the zero oxidation state. And so what you can do is we can oxidize that elemental gold. And so that is moving it from the zero oxidation state to, let's say, plus one oxidation state. So gold exists in these common oxidation states, zero, plus one, plus two, plus three. Okay. And rarely plus five. But the gold one and gold three are the most stable that we use. Okay. And so the oxidation from zero to one would require that it has to have ligands bound to it. Okay. And gold one can only accommodate two ligand sites commonly. But we have developed some more, which has like four sites, but still a gold one. And then you have the gold three, which commonly exists with four linkages connected to the gold center. So it's a linkage to a ligand that we call the coordination
site. Oh, thank you. That's very interesting.
So Dr. Sam, you mentioned the already commercialized drug. I believe you said it was Aniran, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Oranofin. Yeah.
Oranofin. So do you have any commercialized therapeutics in the market, or are there some soon to be commercialized?
That's an interesting question. We don't have one yet that is commercialized from our lab. Okay. However, we have a couple of patents that have been pending right now. We've filed a couple of patents about five patents on different structural scaffolds and their utility in different diseases. So in cancer, in IBD, that's inflammatory bowel disease, like Crohn's disease or colitis. We have one against antifungal, as an antifungal agent. And I think last week or so, we filed one which was really focusing on cancer, but more to do with probing the mitochondria structure, structural integrity. So it could be used as a probe or a therapeutic moving forward. Yeah.
That's
very interesting.
Let's say in a 2 or 3, maybe 4 years' time, there should be something on the market.
Yep. You cautiously become optimistic about these because there are so many loops and so many things that you have to overcome. But the my goal, and as I tell my PhD students and everybody, that the goal is that at least we can get one of our agents into humans, you know, for the treatment of a disease, you know. That's the driving force. That's the motivation for the work that we do. We hope that we can turn some of the findings into real life solutions.
Yeah, that would be really awesome. And so building off of that, how do you see the future of cancer treatment drugs and therapies?
Yeah, so I think that it's never going to go away when it comes to chemotherapy. So there's so many very innovative strategies that have come up, things like immunotherapy. Gene therapy was active about 10 years ago. But chemotherapy will always be there.
Yeah.
The reason why chemotherapy is important is that it's a small molecule. The clearance is pretty effective. There's a tendency that you can minimize or control the side effects in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have something that can engage with your target, your biological target briefly and bounce off, you want that better than having a biologic, which is huge, humongous, that causes a lot of havoc, like some of the monoclonal antibodies. It's a good therapy. There's no question about that. But I think chemotherapy will always have that broad brush across pathophysiologies. Yeah.
That's still very great research and lots of impact. So taking the conversation back home, so what is the state of the cancer research in Africa now? And do you foresee any growth opportunities?
Yeah, so it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. Now, I think one of the things that our bottlenecks for cancer research, but I'm just using cancer research because we work on other disease indications too with various collaborators and not just our lab. But we do a lot of the cancer on our own. The key thing is when you go back home to the African continent, you need original cell lines, you know, to do these experiments. And what I mean by original cell lines is that you want to look at the heterogeneous component of the models that you are using. Because if the models that you are using does not recapitulate the demographic very well, you may do a lot of experiments, but maybe the treatment regimen that you generate may not be in line with the people that you want to treat.
Yeah.
And so the very first thing is, how are our models like? So if we generate cancer lines or we're using cancer lines that are non-native to Africans, there's a chance that you may do fantastic research with other cell lines, but you still will not be in line with.
Yeah.
And that's one of the major problems that I see. So can we get to a level where we are looking at our indigenous people and looking at the demographics and seeing, can we generate cell lines from cancer patients on the continent with proper genotyping various ways where we've sequenced and we know how they behave.
Yeah.
You know, and this is very true, because even in the United States, there's a lot of research into why the African American breast cancer, it's a little bit difficult to treat it, because we have a lot of prevalence in the community.
Yeah.
But then as of now, we still do not have a therapy that treats triple negative breast cancer as an original therapy. We use a lot of combination in the clinic right now.
Yeah.
And so demographics do count, because the genetics are a little bit different. Yeah. And so model systems must be well validated and well crafted. Yeah. The second thing is, I think that we need to invest a lot more in research. Everything must be research focused. I tell the students that science is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we may not see the results right now in the next year or two, but give ourselves 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, something can come out.
Can come out, that's true.
And all the clinical trials that are run are all expensive.
Yep.
And we need to be able to run clinical trials with our own people, with medications that are tailored to the models we've used. So those are the kind of problems that I see.
Okay, well, we're hoping that we can find ways and means to find solutions to some of these problems. And so if you could give an advice to any young and upcoming scientists back in Africa, based on your experience, what you've gone through, and then up to this point, what would you tell any young and upcoming scientists?
Yeah, I think we've got to step back and look at history and see that the African continent has survived a lot of challenges. And over the years, even before the era of colonialism and so forth, the indigenous Africans and the civilization that went on was backed by some technology and discovery and so forth. We're able to survive drought and famine. If you go to northern Ghana, for example, and go to the Dunbar region and so forth, in the 1400s, they were able to survive famine for many, many, many years, according to archaeological findings and surveys. So the point I'm just trying to raise here is that young scientists, let's realize that we have a history of innovation. We have a history that it is possible. We can face troubles and challenges, but that doesn't define us. We have to step above that. That's number one. So look back and see some of the wonderful discoveries that we ourselves have made. I mean, look at even in Ghana, Kente and the technology surrounding it. I mean, this is unbelievable. And no other place have been able to replicate that system or even automated as at now throughout the world. Okay, so discovery and innovation is on our side. The second thing is that I think we've got to be hungry. Young scientists or people desiring to get, stay humble, but stay very hungry. It doesn't matter the obstacles, but be hungry for discovery, be hungry for research, be hungry to contribute to the society that we live in. And I think it's the combination of it is possible and hunger that would propel us to the next level. In terms of resources, we may not be able to control, but then when we get ourselves positioned with these two elements as our feet and working on them, resources will come and we can be able to move things forward. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful advice. With those two words, hunger and possibility, we'd like to bring our session tonight, the first episode of SANI, to an end. I'd like to personally thank Dr. Iwa for joining us tonight, accepting to come and be the very first interviewee for our podcast. We hope to have many more to come. And we believe that his words, his insights, his experience that he shared with us tonight is really going to invigorate the young scientists back in Africa. So thank you all. Thank you once again, Dr. Sam, for joining us. And thank you, everyone watching, for joining our first broadcast of the SANI podcast. And we hope that you have been enlightened. We hope that you've been inspired.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. So don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. So we'll see you at our next session. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.